Hey, folks, I'm not Mark Pelletier. I'm Denise Howell, and I'm joining him today on Futures in Biotech. Along with Eileen Smith-Ewing, we're going to navigate the waters of biotechnology, most specifically gene patents. How do you get them, and why are they there? Also, once you've got them, how are you going to finance your company and move forward? We'll talk about all that next on Futures in Biotech.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Futures in Biotech is provided by CashFly at CashFly.com.
This is Futures in Biotech, episode 94, Getting DNA Right.
I believe that biotech is the next frontier.
Probably the greatest intellectual revolution that's ever taken place in man's history. DNA is the code for life. We're actually beginning to understand how life works, which I think is something that's mind-blowing in and of itself.
There was going to be a genetic component to aging.
How long was there the extension?
About 30-40% for humans. That would equate to something like 20 to 30 years.
How close are we to actually having a therapy?
Ballpark, 10 years.
It's potentially one of the things that'll end up rocking the world the same way that people said, oh, the sun's the center of the universe, oh, this and that and everything. And now here's somebody who can come out and say, hey, look, here's how we compare it to our closest evolutionary relative.
Well, welcome to Futures in Biotech. Today is another experiment, and we tend to do this a lot on Futures in Biotech, where we explore areas that go well beyond my expertise, well, clearly outside my area of expertise. And we're doing this on our 6th year anniversary show. So it's kind of, it goes to the essence of what we do here is try new things. And to do so, I thought it would be a great idea to bring a subject matter expert that has an understanding of the area that we're going to explore. And that guest host is Denise Howell. From This Week in Law on Twit TV. Welcome to the show.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me. Happy 6th anniversary.
Thank you. When you accepted to do the show, I was like, whew, huge relief, because this could be, there's a lot of heavy material to come up. And our guest is very well versed in the matter of law, so and the biotechnology in the law. And one of the reasons why I really wanted to do this show is that we're at a crossroads now, where it's much like the invention of the transistor and how the transistor changed the world. Well, life is a substrate for engineering, right? That means that the processes of life can be seen in a new light, much as a technology, right? So now you've got life that equals technology, and that can be placed in the same framework of intellectual property that drives all technology forward, right? You've got to take a new look at how life is, and it's not just part of us living, but it's something that can be improved upon and in terms of medicine and food. There's a lot of areas that this can really have dramatic changes on the human existence, even to get too, not to get too poetic about it, but you know, you have to have to have economic drivers that drive innovation. You have to have a solid framework to protect investors and inventors, right? It raises a few questions, like who is in the inventor if the process that you're trying to put out intellectual property on is life, right? Who's the inventor? Who can own life? Can you own life? You know, can you frame a business based on living intellectual property? So these are some topics that, you know, are maybe seen at 37,000 feet, and we're going to try and bring it down a little bit. And our guest, is really, well versed in this area and has been working on it for many years. Our guest is Eileen Smith-Ewing. And she did her undergraduate studies at Harvard University, and she went on to earn her JD from Columbia Law School in New York City. She serves as the chair of the Committee on Biotechnology for the American Bar Association, but also the chair of Life Sciences Division, and is a leadership council member, section of Science and Technology Law, and a shareholder at Greenberg Traurig Law Firm in Boston, Massachusetts. She has she's authored several books, including different stakeholders, different deal goals, counseling the merger or sale of a life science company, biotechnology and the law, which was published by the American Bar Association, and the science of the deal, handling transactions for life sciences clients. Welcome to the show. Thank you for coming on.
Hi, Mark. Thank you so much for having me.
Maybe I could ask you to speak a little bit about the fundamental framework of patentability, right? You know, this is too big for me to try and put my head around. And can you own a gene? Can you own a drug target? Can you own a metabolic pathway? How do you frame the law around biotech?
That is something that Congress and the Supreme Court has been struggling with for many years, as I'm sure you know, and those of our listeners who are who have companies dependent on the ability to patent life may have had to grapple with these issues and refine their patent claims to fit within the structure that has emerged so far. Just in a very brief nutshell, I will lay it out for you that there was a case in 1980, Diamond versus Chakrabarty, which arrived at the holding, the Supreme Court case, that even though gene sequences are living things, that it is possible to patent and therefore exclusively own the market rights to a gene sequence, provided that the gene sequence was altered in some way from its form and nature, that it had a known function. If you had the altered gene sequence with a known function, you would be able to patent it. And the case in question was about a man-made microorganism that would drink up oil spills. Great thing to have and a great business to be in if you're the one who has discovered it. The Supreme Court said, well, this is some genetic material that has been altered. It's being processed outside the human body. It has a known function. Yes, you can patent this. That goes back. Sorry, go ahead.
Sure. But, you know, DNA in a test tube that's changed and has a known function is not the organism that you're using to suck up the oil, right? That's metabolizing the oil. So there's a disconnect there. I don't know. Ooh, go ahead.
Well, I think the connect was that the patent claims being laid out were for the organism itself, as well as for the genetic sequence resulting in the organism, resulting in the function. So they had to go all the way back to the gene sequence in order to distinguish it from anything else that might be available or created afterwards.
I'm still having a hard time. Okay, so the DNA. I guess you're saying the patent covers. I guess we're not talking humans here. So the idea of owning a bacteria strain is much like having a good yeast strain that has been, you know, sort of selected for making a really great beer or a specific variety of corn, right?
Precisely. So that's the foundation back in 1980. But then you have to fast forward to today, and I think probably what you're bringing up that's on the minds of many people in the biotech community right now are a couple of recent decisions from the Supreme Court. For example, the Myriad case, genetic diagnostic testing. Can the company that created this genetic diagnostic test that would determine via personalized medicine whether certain individuals would be more prone to certain types of breast and ovarian cancer, could they maintain an exclusive license over that isolated strand of DNA, even though there's a connection to functionality and so forth, even though it was taken out of the human body, the Myriad case has created an awful lot of heat, much more heat than light, on you know, both sides of the table. Those who are strongly behind patients' rights say that allowing a gene sequence that will be used for diagnostic testing, allowing that to be patented at all is restricting patient access to something that they ought to be able to have access to. Those on the other side say, look, the millions, the hundreds of millions of dollars that it may take to bring that, what started out as a DNA sequence, to bring that to market with a function that helps human beings, we've got to incentivize with patents by giving some market exclusivity. So we've gone all the way from the little, you know, creature sucking up the oil spills, which, as you say, that seems commonplace today. So much has been patented that's analogous to that situation. That doesn't seem at all controversial, but the current controversy really goes to genetic diagnostic testing.
I guess that raises two little questions here. What if, you know, the DNA sequence is of a mutation that is seen in nature but alters function, just the same way that people were trying to breed plants for specific properties, right? Be it cold resistance or larger tomatoes. They identify the DNA sequence that through natural selection. Could that be owned if it wasn't synthetically designed?
There's a new Patent Reform Act that has come out, and it makes many, many changes. But on the topic you're talking about, it specifically advises inventors who are filing patent applications to make sure their claims exclude the human body per se. So you would have to define, you know, you would have to define what you're talking about without it being referenced to the human body, essentially.
Oh, okay. So we should be screening for mutations in chimpanzees, which have functionally conserved genes, and then port them back to humans for benefit in terms of gene therapy or so forth.
Mark, it might be helpful to know that the USPTO, when hit with questions like this, goes back to the Constitution and points out that we're not just concerned with inventions under patent law, but also discoveries. So that's how we get into the area of, you know, what you've just brought up, a gene sequence. Certainly nobody invented it, but someone, in fact, discovered it. And that's how they're hanging legal protection on it.
But that raises an important question. The reason why the fellow who has the Institute of Synthetic Biology, I'm drawing a huge blank, Craig Venner. Boy, I look like an idiot to my colleagues. Okay, Craig Venner invented something called the cDNA library, where complementary DNA. So he was the first one to do this. He isolated nucleic acids from the cell, RNA, which is just what's turned on. So you have DNA, it gets copied into RNA, and that RNA becomes like a zipper running through what's called a ribosome and adds amino acids following the RNA. So RNA gets translated into protein. So it's the transcript. So what he did is he took this RNA transcript and then used polymerases to copy back into DNA just the genes that are turned on. Okay, so you have the genome, the chromosomes. RNA gets translated, copied, and then he would then copy the RNA back into DNA and create libraries of single genes at a time with the hopes of owning, discovering the entire functional human genome and then owning it. So based on what Denise was suggesting, that back to the Constitution, discovery can play an important part to assigning intellectual property. Does that still hold true today? Does Craig Venner own the human transcriptome?
I think we have to come back. I don't know. I don't know what particular experiences Craig Venner has had during his, you know, long and very, very interesting scientific history. I don't know what experience he has personally or th- through his entities has had with the U.S. Patent Office. But I think in listening to your description of his work, we come back to where I had started with the principles we know have held through all the Supreme Court cases in terms of altered, isolated sequences with a known function. That is a definite black and white patentability okay situation. Now, you took us through a fairly complex process, and the process itself may be patentable, and the function may certainly add to patentability. That doesn't necessarily go back to the sequence itself, unless the sequence was altered and isolated.
Another thing is, you mentioned, the sequences being potentially proprietary as a diagnostic tool. So if you develop a test to screen for a certain disorder or a certain condition, not necessarily a disorder, but a certain predisposition, and you have that sequence, and then you set up diagnostic kit based on that sequence, you're precluding it, and then you make it a very high price because you have the exclusive rights to it. You could selectively, market this and preclude humanity from, possibly one of the biggest foes, like heart disease, right? And then if the market forces say that you'll make the most money just treating the top 2%, then the economic driving forces that move this forward suggest that 98% of humans should continue to die with heart disease. And it could be just based on the diagnostic process of owning that set. Does that make sense? And so maybe you could explain, because the diagnostic case a little bit. So
certainly,
these are just huge, heavy topics here.
They are, and they're very complicated. And on sometimes when we give an example, or if you give an example that is even slightly different from the one I've been discussing, there may be a fair amount of analysis to be able to give you something approaching an answer. But I'd be happy to talk about the Myriad case, which has generated so much public interest. It's precisely what you're talking about, and what I had mentioned a couple of minutes ago. A certain diagnostic test for subsets of women with breast cancer or ovarian cancer, which will determine their susceptibility and other factors, treatability and so forth of that cancer. But it's been critical for women with breast cancer or ovarian cancer, this test, to try to gain access to it to find if they fall within the subset that will be susceptible to certain treatments. Now, exactly what you said happened with Myriad. And you could say, well, Myriad, licensed this, developed this, paid well for the rights for it, brought it to market. It is under, U.S. patent law. A patent was issued, or a series of patents were issued. And yet there's the public outcry saying these things shouldn't be patentable, because you're restricting patient access. The outcry on the other side of the tennis net, if you will, is, as I mentioned a few minutes ago, how will we ever get these things developed as a business proposition if we don't allow market exclusivity? And all a patent is the right to market exclusively, to sell and market exclusively for a period of some years. It just means that, you don't own that forever, but it means that you can beat off your competitors for a period of years. That's all the patent is. In the Myriad case, the Supreme Court took a very interesting position. The federal court had finally decided that the Myriad genetic diagnostic test was indeed patentable, because an altered form of it from what occurs in the human body was what was being used in the diagnostic test with functionality known.
Oh.
Yeah. So that was the federal court. So we're coming back to the little creatures with the oil spills, you know. So that seemed like a very strong decision, but the Supreme Court granted cert and came out quite a different place this March. This last spring, this May. They decided, and this is another line of cases. I hate to bore you with stuff like that, but this is another line of cases that frequently, as you know, in the law, if judges can't get to a rational decision through one line of cases, they will look at other factors and see if lines of cases, you know, legal cases, studying those other factors might resolve the issue, you know? So what the Supreme Court justices decided so recently in May was that anything that merely describes something that is occurring in nature, a correlation between the levels of something in one's body and one's susceptibility to or efficacy of a drug, what have you. If it's merely a correlation, machine or process or what have you that that intervenes, you can't patent a phenomenon of nature. You can't, even though it would be great to have all the, you know, possible marketable products that are result from the law of gravity. Nobody can get exclusivity on the law of gravity, and so they applied this to the myriad genetic test by saying, "Look, we're not saying that the gene sequence itself may or may not be patentable. That, you know, that's okay, but." Having recently held in another case called Prometheus that, you know, that in situations like these, these biotechnology situations often are simply reporting to the physician whether a certain correlation exists between disease state and efficacy of a drug, what have you. They are merely revealing something that's happening naturally. And that itself, the Supreme Court said, it's phenomenon of nature, and the fact that you found a way to record that phenomenon of nature doesn't make the phenomenon of nature yours. However, there had been such outcry on both sides that the Supreme Court did something. I think that it was a lot more blunt than it usually is in saying at the end of the Myriad opinion, this better go to Congress. Because right. Congress has the capability of making certain exceptions to the patent statutes, as it did for certain types of plants, saying that certain types of modified plants could be owned by companies or by entities. And so, if it's so important for us to have a robust genetic diagnostic industry, if that's the best interest of public policy, we're not going to, you know, rape the progression, the philosophical progression of the patent laws by trying to shoehorn it into all our prior cases. We're saying let Congress deal with genetic diagnostic testing and decide whether it's more important to have patient access or to have a robust industry with an incentive to keep developing new tests.
I can imagine one side of the house saying, "Ah, too much government intrusion," and the other side saying, "Well, we got to take care of everybody." So I don't know. I hope it's less of a partisan issue. I guess it is, right?
People from all sorts of places and all sorts of groups came in. The U.S. Patent and Trademark Office asked for public comment on this very issue, and just a phenomenal amount of commentary at public hearings and then in writing. All of that's available on the PTO website, by the way, if a person really likes this issue and wants to follow the different arguments. I don't think it breaks down on, you know, political partisan lines per se.
One last interjection here, one question I had is, well, you said one of the elements is that provides safety, or sort of a safety net for the greater public good, is that patents are normally held for a limited amount of time. But then that raises the question, is how long has Mickey Mouse been patented or trademarked, right?
It hasn't been. It's been copyrighted.
Copyrighted.
Yes.
Well, DNA is information as well. So couldn't you use a different framework?
There is crossover between the two fields, software patents being a notable kind of one. But in general, when you're talking about a creative work, that's copyright. And when you're talking about an invention or discovery that is useful, you're talking about patents. And there are three different kinds of patents. There's the utility patent, that is a process, machine, etc. There are design patents, which start to look a little bit like copyright. And then there there are plant patents. And Eileen, please jump in and clarify for me, because I'm not a patent lawyer. I'm just a lawyer. So I'm sort of going back to my Hornbook law school knowledge of this stuff here.
I think you're doing very well.
Thank you.
Perhaps better than I would, because I am not a patent lawyer either.
Ah.
These are areas of extreme interest to me, mm-hmm. but I'm a corporate lawyer, and primarily what I do is help biotech and pharmaceutical and medical device life science companies raise capital, enter strategic alliances. I do deals.
But right.
You can't be in the biotech world and not be hearing about these critical gray areas in the patent law that are coming to the fore right now. So I apologize. I didn't That's offer okay. my commentary as an expert, but really as somebody and dealing with clients in the industry every day.
Right. But to answer your question, Mark, I think when you have drawn the line between what's patentable and what's copyrightable, there is a large difference, because copyright terms are, for all intents and purposes, almost endless, based on various legislative and judicial pronouncements on that front. But patent is limited to 20 years.
But, you know, on the copyright aspect, if it's only what has become creative, you know, I made maybe 1,000 DNA constructs in the past 20 years. Mm-hmm. And those DNA constructs, I find they're quite pretty. There's some elements of design
sure.
that go beyond just the genetic code that informs the order of amino acids and how that forms a protein. So, but I digress.
The visual design may be copyrightable.
You can have a symphony with DNA.
Yeah.
I was going to say that if you wanted to perhaps, you know, start a line of, you know, home furnishings, wallpaper, upholstery, and so forth, that certainly you could get some exclusivity in that area, I'm sure, with a DNA patterns.
Yeah, Eileen, I have a question for you. Reading back through my ancient notes on gene patents, I looked at this issue a long time ago and tried to assure, you know, make myself comfortable that genes, in fact, were patentable, and try and understand why. I remember reading that, of course, you've mentioned these already today, that isolation and purification are really, really important. And then there has to be a usefulness component in order for a gene patent to be issued. Can you tell me why isolation and purification have these magic kind of qualities for the USPTO, why that is the touchstone?
I think it comes back to not being able to patent generally. Now, if we leave the plant patents aside, because that was a congressional exception, the idea that simply the fact that you have seen something in nature does not make it patentable.
Mm-hmm.
You've observed it. You've, you know, under your microscope, or, you know, however you have done so, you can't say, okay, I'm the first one to see that, and therefore my being able to describe it to the rest of you is makes it patentable by me. No, it's got to be something. The isolation and the change is what makes it under the our patent scheme, what makes it different from something observable in nature and therefore belonging to all of us.
And those two things then in turn make it useful in some way, or the person urging the patent in any way has to come forward and say, okay, I've isolated, I purified it, and here's what we can now use it for. Is that right?
Exactly. Well, there has to be a function. You know, utility is part of, you know, along with novelty, part of the things that are examined for patentability. Yes, particularly with these gene sequences, you know, it's not enough to observe them in nature. It's probably not enough to just get them in an unnatural state, a state that has been manipulated by a human being. But you've got to be able to show that, darn, it's going to do something now, you know?
Right, for better or
worse.
That's
the hard part.
One other good thing to bear in mind is just because we're all running around with various things that may be isolated, purified, and deemed useful in some way inside our genetic makeup, we're not infringing because of that. Eileen, you want to explain how that works?
Well, I'm sorry, I you lost me a little bit. If it's within our genetic makeup,
right? Just because we have adrenaline in our body doesn't mean that we are infringing some patented strain of adrenaline.
Absolutely not. And yep. Because ours is not isolated and altered. Ours yes. is as it occurs in the human form.
So we can at least take heart from that.
I mean, we could ask questions on this in this area probably for the next, you know, 10 hours. We're going to do a series on biotechnology law. But I guess one question that keeps I'm picturing in my head is the three-dimensional cell cultures. They're establishing the technology to grow human kidneys. At one point, is the human kidney, I guess it's the pathway. So if I understand correctly from what I learned today, it's the pathway or the techniques to make a human kidney are patentable, but the human kidney itself, the synthetic human kidney, would probably not be patentable.
I'm not sure because, as you say, it all comes down to what nine justices in black robes will say on a given day, you know. But I would think you're right. I would think that the important and most obviously patentable parts of this would be the processes by which the synthetic kidney was created. Now, if it truly is a synthetic kidney, well, now we're in a gray area because it's not a kidney. It's not a real kidney. It's a kidney that mimics one that would have been taken out of a human's body. So I think a good lawyer might be able to argue that, you know.
Well, if it works like a human kidney and it's made with human cells and it's got, 46 chromosomes, is it a human kidney?
Now we're getting deep into philosophy and religion.
Okay, how about we twist this a little bit. Oh, one last question on this area. I promise it's the last one. So you're... From what I understand, the laws, the frameworks for patent law that were developed or initiated in the 19th century are still applied to 21st century biotech.
There has been, just as there's been evolution in science, there has been continual evolution in the law. But I think that probably the groundbreaking case in the genetic sequence area is that Chakrabarty case that I mentioned. And that's 1980, which seems like a long time ago to many of us, but really along the lifeline of patent law is fairly recent history.
I'll direct the audience to an episode with Ron Evans somewhere maybe 3 years ago, maybe four. He was one of the individuals, I think the individual, if I recall the show correctly, it's been a long time, that cloned the first human gene, and they waited to a Senate vote to pass, and then at midnight, he was in the lab ready to go, did his bacterial transformation to isolate, and when you transform a bacteria, you give one gene each, and you select the bacteria for specific properties, and he was able to have the one grow that had the properties of the gene that he wanted, and isolated the first human gene. So it's interesting how, you know, the scientists are all waiting with bated breaths on the development of law, and and then do move forward based on the, you know, the decisions made at least in the U.S. and Congress. So it's pretty neat. It does sort of control our work in greater respect.
And that, you know, it both may incentivize or take incentives away from you to do the work you really would want to do in any case. It's not knowing how Congress will come out on some of these issues, such as diagnostic testing, maybe delaying funding, the willingness of investors to fund a variety of genetic diagnostic companies. It may be holding up sponsored research in labs with research institutions, because without the funding, without industry funding, which comes from investors, then, you know, we don't get as much done. So all the way down or up the chain, it has a chilling effect until we get the law straight.
Eileen, maybe you could help us understand why the Patent Office has decided to go in this direction by telling us some of the useful things that have been created out of patented genes, how these things have become important in our medical arena today.
Wow, that's...
I know there's probably so you could go on for 2 hours answering that question, yeah. But just some concrete examples.
I can give an example of the company that I've developed here. Mm-hmm. There's some, I don't know, Eileen, would that be okay?
I would like that, please.
Well, my lawyers are listening. Okay, wait. So I'm not going to divulge what we're doing, but we're working on a protein that's in the human brain. Mm-hmm. And that protein is expressed at a very specific place. And its function is such that if you block it, you prevent water from entering the brain after a stroke or brain trauma. And we've developed some compounds that go and attach itself to that protein. And our intellectual property is based on the ability to block the process of movement of water from the blood to the brain. And so the IP on that in that situation is on the invention of the chemistry or on the use of this chemistry for that specific function. So that's an example of how you could use you can create value in a biotechnology setting. Does that sort of answer the question? It's not DNA per se, it's more pharma.
Sure.
But I suppose if we had a novel synthetic gene that we could target to the brain that would result in the same type of function, we could end up potentially saving, you know, a million lives a year in the U.S. And Europe. I mean, those are the numbers I know.
Of course, people who discover these kinds of things can also make the choice not to patent, but to open source their discoveries.
Well, that would be a huge mistake.
Okay, discuss right? Why.
The idea of doing open source pharma, I mean, it makes a lot of ethical, it seems like the right thing to do. But if you're going to go through a multi-center phase 3 clinical trial, it's going to cost you $125 million. Mm-hmm. Unless you can make it a value to the investor to pay for the $125 million, it's not likely to go forward. And government's not going to come in with $125 million open source, you know, support, I don't think. It's not
and
the
then
role
meanwhile, meanwhile, Mark, you're absolutely right that while you the person you're talking about, in out of the goodness of your heart has taken the results of perhaps your life work and made it available to everyone to work on freely, to the extent that it does then need a strategic ally to come in and put bucket loads of money in to make it marketable and commercializable, that ally is going to realize that they're not going to be able to make much money on it because 10 other large pharmas will also be able to do much the same thing and have something out there in the marketplace pretty quickly alongside them. And then the only protection that they have is first to market. And for hundreds of millions of dollars, that's probably not perceived as a good investment. So by making this public disclosure, you may in fact have slammed the door on the thing ever getting commercialized.
And millions of people will die because of your IP decision.
Yes, nobody wants that.
Yeah, no. Well, seriously.
Yeah.
We thought about it, and we went on a trade secret for the longest time. Mm-hmm. And because as soon as you also, this is another element, as soon as you patent, the patent has a life. And if the market for your drug is, say, $500 million a year, which is reasonable for an important medical issue, and you have, 14 or 20 years to make money on it, if you patent right away coming out of your research, and it takes you 10 years to develop, you have 4-year lifespan. And for every year, you're losing $500 million. And then it makes it less and less and less interesting to go through the risk of investing and putting that money aside so that you can develop it. Is there a precedent? Go ahead. You had a question?
I was going to say that then puts more pressure on you and your investors or strategic partners, what have you, as you get further and further along the lifeline. And yet you're still, you're still doing clinical trials. You're still refining concepts. You're still, you start to have to turn your attention towards developing refinements of your original IP that may themselves have the effect of prolonging the lifespan, not, necessarily of the original stuff, but giving you market exclusivity in something that is kind of the next generation.
So one thing, though, to distinguish in what we're talking about is that the human genome itself, not the isolated, purified, and then stated as useful part of it, but the genome itself is open source and freely available. Is that accurate, Eileen?
That's my understanding, and that makes sense. Based on our country's patent philosophy, that's something occurring in nature, and it took a lot of work to be able to describe it, but it's a natural phenomenon.
In fact, I just found a good post on Boing Boing from Margie Korth Baker over there, who noted at the World Science Festival earlier this week on June 4th. They were talking about thousands of sequenced human genomes being freely available, but you might not know how to find them. And she has some resources there for how you would go about making use of that information, if anyone's interested.
You also raise a good point, Denise. There is a fellow named Drew Endy who's at Stanford. He's been on the show. Well, he was one of the first individuals. He was at MIT at the time to be on Futures in Biotech in the first year, 6 years ago. He's created an open source set of tools, and I think he calls it open wetware. You'd have to Google it. But Drew Endy was involved in this project at MIT, and I think it's continued at Stanford. And he considers DNA to be equipment, and he really sees genetics as an engineering challenge more than a biology challenge. And as a matter of fact, I think he told me, was it off air or on air? I think it was on air, that he had, bought a DNA library of some sorts. And when he had to bill it in his grant management, he billed it as equipment, not as reagents. So the idea of making DNA sequences available, even synthetic DNA, available as open source material, is possible. Will it lead to significant innovation? One might ask: Is Linux an economic driving force? Has it made a contribution to innovation as well? I think so. There's been a lot of stuff ported from Linux to Windows, Linux to Mac. I think so. So maybe. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, definitely. And I don't think anybody could argue that Android is a pretty wonderful thing.
There you go.
Yeah.
And yeah, but that's what's the product, and what's the what's getting sold? And I think Android, it's the users that are getting sold, not the Android unit itself, right? The Android operating system. And I guess if you use human biology as the product, and
well, that's the big controversy, isn't it?
Or as we call them, humans.
Yes.
How about we switch over to raising capital? Because I think we're getting somewhat limited on time, and one thing I'd like to do with Futures in Biotech is give all those graduate students and postdocs and professors the opportunity to envisage their science translating into the clinic or into a very useful market, so that they can and eventually hopefully benefit mankind. And scientists are trained to ask questions and to try and address major issues, but there's often this disconnect on how, because we don't get business training in those 14 years of college. Perhaps Eileen could speak a little bit to some of the best ways to raise capital to translate work from an academic lab or a small company into the market.
Well, just like any other technology, you're starting out with angel investors and venture capital firms. However, the news in those areas, particularly in the VC funding area, has been pretty negative for the biotech industry over the last several years. There was a survey I read that was put out by National Venture Capital Association, and they found that 41% of venture capital firms were reporting that they were investing less now in biotech companies than they had in any of the past 3 years. And on another part of the survey, 40% of that same group of venture capital, major venture capital firms, were saying that they intended over the next 3 years to cut back their investment interest in biotech even further. So venture capital is there, but it will only take you so far. And these days, I think it will take you less far along the drug or biologic or healthcare product approval path line than ever before, because the VCs have more pressure on them from their limited partners than ever before, which means that the good news, I think, is that the biotech industry follows a certain model that I think is not really replicated in any other industry, where the big players, maybe the top 25 pharmaceutical companies, are heavily responsible for entering into research and product development alliances with so many small companies, hundreds of thousands of small biotech companies. And when the venture capital runs out, or appears to be, they appear to be less willing to enter the next round, the only way you're going to get through clinical trials is by the partnership with the big guy. And how to do that in terms of licensing some of your intellectual property, but at the same time making sure that you're getting a fair deal that is not too back-ended in terms of milestones, royalties, and so on, and that you are also crafting the deal so that your intellectual property and the possible uses of it, let's say for a variety of medical indications or other ways of slicing and dicing the products you might eventually develop, making sure that your first love in big pharma is not necessarily the only person you ever date. It becomes important not to have a first deal, no matter how wonderful it is and how validating to your investors. It becomes very important to carefully craft the IP rights you license and the field and product area you license, so that you may well have the chance to enter numerous other rewarding strategic alliances along the pathway to product approval.
I'm writing this down. That's free advice.
Well, call me afterwards. I'll tell you again.
Eileen, I have a quick question. Do you think that the Jobs Act may disrupt any of the way that biotech companies fund themselves? Do you have clients who are interested in using its crowdsourcing aspects, crowdfunding aspects?
That's a very good question. And there's a fair amount of debate, I think, about that aspect of the Jobs Act, which I guess for anybody who hasn't heard of it, I guess it's jumpstart our startup businesses, or our business startup, something like that, the acronym Jobs. I don't know that crowdfunding is realistically going to have that much effect on biotech companies who want to raise capital. Perhaps at the very early stage, and for a company that is just trying to get proof of concept, or is trying to, and perhaps a simple medical device, what have you, that's easily explained to the public. The problem with crowdfunding is that you can only raise $1 million with it, and your individual non-accredited investors, that's a term of art, but it's folks who make less than a certain quite comfortable amount of money, or have less than a certain quite comfortable net worth, your non-accredited investors can put in no more than $2,000 or 5% of their annual income or net worth. So the larger of the two. So, I mean, for a biotech company to raise $1 million, sadly, unless it's at very early days, it's not going to do too much good for them. Mm-hmm. I think the main worry for some of us is that while legitimate biotech companies may not make use of the crowdfunding opportunity simply because it's just $1 million, and then you have lots of pesky common shareholders who will be coming to every meeting and adding their point of view for the $2,000 that they gave you. The legitimate biotech companies may not go that route. One worries, though, that the sentimental value to the public of finding cures for, certain diseases is so strong, so important. I mean, look how many people will turn out for, a march for breast cancer or for heart disease or what have you, and, put so much of themselves in that, the folks on Main Street may be very willing, if they get an offer in the mail, what we call a general solicitation, to send in $2,000 and, okay, they're going to get one share of a snake oil company. So I'm more worried about I don't think the legitimate biotech companies will make too much use of the route, but I'm worried that folks are going to be scammed by thinking that they're helping something truly wonderful, when in fact any effort in that direction would be trying to raise a whole lot more than $1 million. Now, what has happened with the Jobs Act is that some typical forms of raising capital have been really streamlined and made a lot easier. And this probably will help biotech companies. One way that you can raise a large amount of money without taking your company public and thereby incurring all the costs of compliance and whatnot is through something called Regulation A. It's one exception or exemption that the SEC offers to do a direct offering and still raise a limited amount of money with less compliance obligations. It used to be that Schedule A was limited to $5 million. That cap has been raised to $50 million. General solicitation, in other words, doing internet solicitations or mail solicitations or what have you, are now permitted so long as the actual purchasers all turn out to be and all verify that they are accredited investors, those folks with the net worth that that we just talked about earlier. This this is great because companies who raise up to $50 million, and by the way, they have to be something that Congress calls emerging growth companies, which is pretty easy, making, you know, under a billion or so in revenues per year. These emerging growth companies, once they do a direct public offering through through A, are able to trade on public exchanges, and their shares are freely tradable without restrictions. Now, as you know, when you do a private offering, when you sell shares to venture capitalists or, you know, mom and pop or next door neighbor or what have you, there are restrictions on their selling those shares onward. Very, very strict rules about preventing that until the company goes public. But this sort of Regulation A offering can take a company into the public markets, raise a fair amount of much more capital than they could have previously with A, much more streamlined, and the shares will be freely saleable onward. There are a number of other things in the Jobs Act that are very helpful, such as if an emerging growth company, such as a biotech company, goes public, the Sarbanes-Oxley, some of the Sarbanes-Oxley restrictions and compliance obligations are waived for the first couple of years that they are a publicly traded company. The number of public offerings of smaller companies, let's say public offerings for up to $50 million. Back in 2004, there were over 40 such offerings in that dollar range. There have only been three thus far in 2012 of companies up to raising up to $50 million. And the number in 2011 was single digits also. So IPOs, because of Sarbanes-Oxley and these very strict requirements of compliance and accountability, financial accountability and otherwise, IPOs have become a lot less attractive, not to mention, you know, the rest of the economic issues that make the bear pressure on the public markets. So the fact that the Jobs Act is both taking away some of the Sarbanes-Oxley restrictions and compliance obligations on new emerging growth companies entering the public markets, and the fact that the A offerings have been raised to $50 million, both of those could have very, very positive effects on viable biotech companies that are not ready to do a true IPO yet, or that are ready for an IPO, but were it but for the expense of all the compliance obligations.
I'm thinking a little bit. That's okay. You know, I want people to realize try and explain a little bit that you know, biotechnology as a technology where you do develop is very expensive, and it's not that the employees are highly paid scientists. We are kind of on the low end of the scale here for the in not even considering education. It's just because it rarely comes to a commercial product. I mean, there's a lot of R&D that's exploring. So exploring is not a highly paid venture, but it's very expensive. Much like trying to send a probe to Mars, trying to figure out the mechanism of a major disease or problem, medical problem, can be time consuming. It could take 20 years. It could take or once you already know how the medical issue, the molecular pathology. Molecular pathology of a disorder, it could take you 5 to 10 years to get a handle of where there's an actual value in what you've discovered. You know, translating it from, yeah, sure, it works in the lab on cells. Does it work in an animal? Does it work in an animal? Yeah, but would that work in a large animal? Would it work? Can you test it? Can you verify it? Can you make it safe for humans? All that is extremely expensive. And, you know, the idea of spending $20 million in 10 years may or may not get you to a point where it's a value for an investor as a shareholder, you know, going public, even after 10 employees, $20 million, 20 years. Expect two employees to cost $600,000 a year. And that is conservative. And you are going to risk, there's a huge amount of risk in even at that kind of funding. You're looking at best 1 in 3 succeeding, probably more like 1 in 10 succeeding. So, yeah, it's an incredible process, right?
It's daunting.
It's quite daunting. Like the weight of our shoulders. So, but you know, it's fun, and you know. Investors have a different sense as well when they're investing in a company that may have a cure for cancer or may have a cure for heart disease, a new gene therapy that improves the outcome of the heart after a heart attack. And there's this sort of social contribution, sort of a positive social contribution when investors, not only do they get a share in the company, they also have the hope of being part of a group that is going to do good. For the most part, right? There's not that many. Are there biotechnology companies that are trying to do evil? I mean, there's no money in evil. there's money in good. People aren't going to pay to die, but they'll pay to survive. So I think if you can help them survive and do better, improve their quality of life, I think there's something to be said for those investors that are willing to take that extra time, right? Because when you invest in the development of a product, be it a toy or a car or something useful and a device that's for communications or what. So that might take 5 years and you've got to start getting a return on your investment. Biotechnology is a long haul and hopefully it's going to get quicker. I mean, the tools are becoming more and more accessible, and what we can do is becoming more and more accessible. As I said, I've got a company here of 6 employees, and we hope to replace a whole wing of Pfizer so that they can focus on doing the larger scale human experiments, right? The humans. I think this might be a good time to, you know, take a step back and think about what was said. This has been a heavy show. And
can I make it a tad heavier?
Go ahead.
The IRC JABA 678 in there is taking issue with your contention that you would always tend toward the beneficial kinds of biological elements, and he throws biological warfare into the mix as a potentially profitable business model that all of this stuff could go toward. And I've got to say, he's got a point.
Yeah, that's not where the big money is.
Ah.
Right? look, what are the statistics? 1 in 5 have heart disease. 1 in 7 have cancer. 1 in 20 have a stroke. If you can fix those 3 major problems, you will save 1 billion lives from premature death and make the greatest contribution to humanity. Right, that could possibly. The only thing worse than 1 in 5 dying of cancer or of heart disease, 1 in 7 dying of cancer, 1 of 20 dying of stroke. The only thing worse than having 1 billion people die prematurely per generation. That's about right. 1 in 7 total. 1 in 8. The only thing worse than that is human annihilation. Right. Mm-hmm. So, if we can improve, health using biotechnology, we could potentially do the opposite of human annihilation and, flip it on its head and make this life thing that we have going pretty good.
I hope so. Think about that. If we don't annihilate ourselves first.
there's war and disease, right? And taxes. I don't want to forget taxes. Maybe we could get rid of them first. That'd probably be the easiest thing to do. But then that's for another show. Maybe that's for 12. This week long. Guys can talk taxes.
War, and disease, and taxes. Sure. Throw some zombies into the mix.
Yeah, it'd be fun. Well, I'd like to... to thank you, Denise, for coming on and helping us out with this this heavy material. It really was a relief to know that you were coming on, and you know, to have someone in the TWIT family, it makes it extra special. So people can tune in to Denise's podcast, This Week in Law, or Netcast, on TWIT TV. Thank you for coming in. It's great to have you in studio too. This is great. It's fun when FIB has somebody in studio.
Yes, it's been really fun for me. These are great, weighty topics, and I know that they confound a lot of people, so I'm glad you've done a show on it.
Well, thanks for coming on. This is great. I'd also like to thank Eileen Smith Ewing for explaining a little bit, for introducing us to the concepts of biotechnology law. And you've been very patient and with our questions and very generous. So thank you so much for coming on.
Oh, it's been my pleasure.
People can find you at Greenberg Trorig. I think it's pretty easy to find. You can basically Google biotechnology law and find Eileen Smith Ewing. So, but if you add Greenberg Trorig, they'll get directly to your contact information if they need any kind of advice or...
always happy to just brainstorm with people and share ideas.
Fantastic. Thanks again for coming on. And I'd also like to thank the folks that make this possible. Liz Romero is producing the show and is taking care of all the audio and video recordings. I'd also like to thank Jeff Stewart and his team for editing the show. I'd also like to thank Chief Twit, Leo Laporte, and everyone else at the Brickhouse for making Futures in Biotech possible. If you have any comments or suggestions, you can reach me at Mark, M-A-R-C, at twit.tv, or on Twitter at Mark Pelletier, M-A-R-C, P-E-L-L-E-T-I-E-R. So for Futures in Biotech, I'm Mark Pelletier.